Hi, I'm Rick Reynolds, and you're listening to A Fair Recovery Radio, Radio to the Power of God. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, sponsors, or advertisers of this station. Due to the sensitive nature of the topics discussed on this program, it is not suitable for children, so we strongly advise that children not be within listening range of this program. Also, please be advised that while we are counselors, what we're doing here tonight is not counseling, and if you have a need, we strongly advise that you seek professional help. The Affair Recovery Center is a community of counseling professionals and couples who have experienced the abundant blessing of reconciliation and renewal. We are dedicated to the restoration of marriages crippled by infidelity. Our mission is to offer hope, support, and recovery for couples and individuals who have suffered the pain as a result of infidelity, betrayal, or sexual addiction. We truly believe there's nothing the nearness of God cannot heal.
Hello and welcome to A Fair Recovery Radio. I'm Wayne Baker, again here with Dr. Karen Royer. So Karen, we were here, two or three weeks ago, and talked about abuse and made a link from abuse, the survivor of abuse, also to somebody that is struggling through infidelity, and how that can be a form of abuse too, that we don't always look at it that way. And a couple other things we talked about that we just barely seemed to touch on were shame and what was the other?
Contempt, right.
Contempt
we talked about just a little bit.
Yeah. So I think we wanted to talk a little bit more about shame, both from the adult survivors of abuse standpoint, but because I know you and I come at it from different angles because of the population that we were, the clients that we work with.
Yeah, you've worked a little more with
sexual addiction with the addiction part, right?
And so I think it's going to be great to have that perspective. And I've worked more with abuse clientele.
Yeah. So this will be interesting. I think there's a lot of overlap, but so do you have any thoughts on where we start on dealing or talking about shame? What how do you define it, I guess?
Well, it's really interesting. I spent part of yesterday and today re-looking at all the books that I had and what I knew about shame, and just wanted to be able to see what was out there. And there is a lot of confusion in the literature about what shame really is and how it's linked or where it's linked to abuse. But I would define exposure as a key part of shame, because exposure is the key element behind it. Shame is an experience of the eyes, and there is no shame when we do something dreadful and there's no possibility of someone important finding out. However, because that possibility exists, the terror of possible future exposure is often so much more agonizing than the shame of actually being exposed. Shame is about being ashamed of who you are, and is very invasive in your thought patterns. So it's like a core issue of who am I as a woman of God, and who are you as a man of God?
Well, that's kind of interesting to think about it being a exposure. I had never heard that or thought of that, but is it kind of like the fear of exposure as opposed to, I don't know, just actually being exposed? Or,
well, I think fear is a huge component, and it's, again, we talked the last time about being a child who suffered from abuse, and at some level the child knows it's wrong, but they just don't have that mechanism. But because they know, they build this shame core because they're afraid, and there's the fear. They're afraid to tell someone because they won't be believed, or because there's a big power issue, or perhaps it's an incestuous relationship. And so that really does minimize their chance of telling someone who could do something about the abuse.
So then it also entails a lot of alienation, I guess.
Absolutely.
And then feelings of inadequacy and
And a lot of compulsive behaviors, which
self-contempt.
We see a lot, yes, self-contempt,
yeah, sure.
And drug and alcohol, substance abuse, eating disorders, addiction to money or work, and other activities that we don't like to talk about, sexual perversions, excessive need to be in control, lack of self-control, gossiping, judgmental spirit, and on the list goes, can also lead to depression, which is a category in itself that we could talk about for a long time, and a deep sense of inferiority. The thinking is flawed that there is something really wrong with me and how I think. Could also include failure syndrome, loneliness that just isolates you from other people, lack of self-confidence, neurotic behavior, perfectionism, which is another topic in itself, and fear of all types, which of course leads to the inability to maintain a healthy relationship with anyone. So how about you? How do you define shame?
Well, I think we're really kind of right there around the same place. It's interesting to think, I don't want to go back to exposure too much, but that's just an interesting way for me to kind of frame it now. I've never heard that before until you mentioned that. So that's kind of cool. Broadens my understanding of it. But I think it also, like you just said, it affects the ability to form lasting, loving relationships where we honor ourselves and each other adequately.
And
I think, don't you see too in your practice where it doesn't only affect this current couple that's dealing with shame of whatever sources or magnitude, but also for future generations as well?
It really does. And that component was real hard for me to fit into my belief system, because I thought, surely I can, you know, I'm not going to perpetuate abuse or... But, you know, children are very smart, and they're very intuitive, and they can pick up on those things as you go through life. It's really, that's really true.
Yeah. It originates, I think, too, from just this inadequate early developmental caretaking. And I'm not a therapist that bashes parents or blames parents, because I think for most of the time, most parents do the best they can with what they've got.
They really do.
So I'm not one of those therapists that likes to beat parents up. But inadequate caretaking, whether it's abandonment or neglect or just working just to make ends meet, you know, I think a lot of it's about the perception of what was going on too, instead of what possibly was actually going on.
Yes, I think a lot of times we remember incorrectly, or we make that memory fit ourselves, and it's an inaccurate view of what's really going on. And I don't like to bash parenting either, because the only reason if you do bash parenting, you haven't had kids.
I
know. Have some kids.
You and Bud are a little ahead of Amy and I. You know, we have a 16-year-old and a 12-year-old, and I think having a teenager just forces you to be on your knees more than you ever thought, right?
And on your toes.
Yeah, exactly.
And it doesn't, you know, it doesn't stop there. It doesn't stop when they're 16, because my kids are twice as old as your kids. And you're still on your knees for them.
Yeah.
But what is very helpful is you have grandchildren and you realize a lot of that stuff was not as important as you thought it was.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I'm curious, you know, just as I work with clients that are coming, their shame is coming from some of their behaviors that they have participated in, sexually addictive behaviors.
Yes.
And I know you mostly work, like we touched on a minute ago, with abused clients. How is it for them? I mean, I can see where, because I think one of the common things about shame is that it doesn't tell me that I did something bad. It tells me that I am bad, is the core message of shame.
That's the core message.
So how does somebody that's abused receive that? And what does it look like for her or for him?
Well, I see it as being so pervasive, because it touches everything, absolutely everything that person is about. Shame as a constant companion for her or for him. So And you see it coming out in, especially in those addictive behaviors that we've talked about. So might you talk about that just a little bit more?
Yeah.
About those?
Yeah. Well, a lot of the times with shame, there's this cycle, you know, that in the moment of acting out, whether it's through pornography or any kind of sexual acting out, prostitution or what have you, there's this high. And then as soon as the acting out is over, then comes the shame and the feelings of despair and loneliness, deep, profound sadness. And it gets into this vicious cycle for these guys and women too, that the only thing that's going to give them relief from that shame is to act out again. Mm. And so it's this downward spiral, you know, just until you stop the cycle. And then it's not over, you know, because you may begin to deal with the shame, and we can talk maybe later about some ways to reduce the shame.
Yes.
But how you get rid of it. But then what's going to come is pretty profound loss, feelings of loss and grief of some of this maybe childhood traumatic events or memories.
And do you see that addictive cycle being a way to sabotage success? Do you see that happening?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I see a lot of my clients, when they think they're on the verge of success or on the verge of breakthrough, then it's real easy for them to relapse into that shame pattern again.
I think because a lot of times they were told, you know, if they weren't told that the message was you aren't good enough or you're not smart enough or pretty enough or you're not enough, so they're just going to prove it. You know?
Well, certainly that's what I did in my life was I became a people pleaser and I made sure that I made great grades and that my parents were proud of me and that, you know, I became a performance addict, which is kind of sad.
Yeah. Hence all the degrees, right?
It is. It's all the degrees and it's not based on that.
Yeah. But I think it's pretty common too, this performance trap. That's a pretty common element, I think, too. What about I don't know if you where you want to head, but I have several questions just rattling around through
my
head.
Well, let's go there.
Do you feel like I read in the literature about shame, there's this topic of a healthy shame, and I come at it as an approach where with my clients I want to kill shame. I don't think it's good, bad, or indifferent. I want it gone. What do you think about the notion that there is a healthy shame?
Well, I have a little trouble with that, too. And I was reading one of my mentors today, and he, in fact, says that some shame is legitimate. The shame that we feel when we've demeaned or slighted another human being, or we've been humbled, or our relationships don't work out. And he says that legitimate shame exposes our rebellion against God. So that type of shame just requires 1 John 1:9, where you confess your sins and then you're back in vertical right relationship with God. And of course, you've gotten your horizontal relationships right too. But I don't know if it's right to call that shame or not. Have you kind of rattled around with that too?
Well, just today and yesterday when I was reading more about it, I have a hard time with that. If it propels you, possibly, but I don't know that's shame. If it's propelling you to, deeper relationship with God, propelling you to take responsibility for some of your actions.
Yeah, can it just be the Holy Spirit and good old conviction for sin?
Yeah.
You know, does it need to be called legitimate shame?
Yeah.
That's kind of the struggle that I have.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm thinking as well. So what do you do for your abused clients to help them kind of walk through the shame? What do you do? What's your protocol?
Well, remember, it goes back to exposure. So one of the first things that we do is have, when we're in a group or when we're in an individual session, is to have the client retell her story. And now, granted, the first time she tells it to someone, and it's safety is so key for these women and men who've been abused, they have to feel safe. So it's not surprising that they would disclose just a little bit of information. So during the course of counseling or a group work, it may take a while to get the whole story. But once she has exposed that story and she has people who then stay and love her and begin to point her in the direction of becoming God's beloved, because we really do want to move them to seeing themselves as God's beloved child who is righteous before God. That's a leap.
That takes time.
Takes time.
And as you're saying that, I'm thinking, you know, I know you and I and John and Leslie and Rick, I think everybody at a Fair Recovery Center, I think that's a big reason why we are such big believers in groups. Because I think in the context of groups that I don't know if it happens quicker, but it seems more solid than it just does in a one-on-one counseling relationship. It can happen there for sure.
It can.
But I think that's why I love the groups, because you get to tell your story, maybe slowly, but that just acceptance of, for the addict, what you've done, for the abused, what's been done to you, and you can share your story and feel safe and loved and respected by a group of people.
That's so right, Wayne. And I really think that when you see that there are other people who have gone through similar things as you have, it's just, you're right, it feels solid and it feels sound to be able to hear someone else's story and they stay in your life. Because so many times, if you've risked to tell your story to someone and they're not comfortable with it, they don't know what to do. And so they may back up. And that's more confirmation that this person, you know, it's like self-fulfilling prophecy. I am not worthy because you just backed up from me and you're not in relationship with me. I love group work.
Yeah. Well, I think it's time for us to take a break. So please stay with us and we'll be back in just a minute.
If you could have the marriage you've always wanted, even after being cheated on, if you could avoid losing a huge chunk of your standard of living, why would you sentence yourself to an empty, lonely room? Divorce sucks. The emotional trauma and financial loss are much worse than what you think. And infidelity can be cured. It's not as hopeless as it seems. AffairRecovery.com. Almost 90% of the couples completing our program not only enjoy restored marriages, they report a much higher level of marital satisfaction. AffairRecovery.com. Don't give up before it gets better. Join the ranks of those who found new life. AffairRecovery.com. Where healing happens.
Hope. Hope for the brokenhearted. Hope for those who have made a mistake. Hope for those impacted by a betrayal. Hope for couples who feel no hope. The Affair Recovery Center is designed to offer hope, direction, and help for couples and individuals whose lives have been ripped by infidelity. There is hope at the Affair Recovery Center. We can all personally testify to what God can do by what we have personally experienced. Let us help. We are a community of counseling professionals and couples who have experienced the abundant blessing of reconciliation and renewal. We are dedicated to the restoration of marriages crippled by infidelity. Our mission is to offer hope, support, and recovery for couples and individuals who have suffered pain as a result of infidelity, betrayal, or sexual addiction. We can be reached at affairrecovery.com, or you can call toll-free at 888-527-2367. That's 888-527-2367.
So welcome back to A Fair Recovery Radio. I'm Wayne Baker with Dr. Karen Royer, and tonight we are talking about shame, both from an abused person's perspective, because that's mostly the population that Karen works with, and from an addict or an unfaithful husband or spouse. We both work with those folks, but we're just coming at this from different directions. And so we're just talking about similarities and differences between the two. So Karen, one of the things that we mentioned also or touched on, the difference between guilt and shame. I hear those terms used a lot, almost interchangeably at times. And I think of it as... guilt says I did something bad, and shame says I am bad.
Right.
It's interesting too, as I think about some of my old coursework. With a lot of this started with Freud, in that he focused on guilt and not shame. So I wonder if he had it wrong, or if we all have tended to focus on guilt more than shame until here the last few years.
I think you're probably right. And, you know, Freud did so much to lay foundation work.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a little bit of Freud I like.
Yeah, there's a little bit. Yeah, I agree with you. There's a little bit there's I like, too.
Defense mechanisms are good.
But,
yeah, I think, remember before I was talking about legitimate shame?
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's guilt. That's legitimate guilt or conviction.
Okay.
And I think conviction's a better word than guilt.
I agree. Yeah. I don't think guilt helps either.
No, I think guilt is it's demeaning. And then it goes back to that that core issue that we're talking about, where shame has impacted our lives and we think we're not worthy.
Yeah.
And we are worthy in God's sight.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's the shame and the guilt, but probably more so the shame that's going to drive those addictive behaviors, whether it's sexual addiction or control or spending or...
So are we just talking semantics here, you think?
Probably. Maybe.
Well, probably so. I mean, I think things, as time goes on, I think things begin to change. And that's that would be a good thing to change, that kind of misnomer between guilt and legitimate shame.
I have a question.
Okay.
It slipped out of my mind, actually, because I was waiting to ask you. It'll come back.
Okay. Tell everybody who you are.
I'm Ronnie Stone, the engineer.
Ronnie's with us every Sunday that we are here, and we are grateful for her.
That's right.
Oh, I love the show, so.
Well, so you had also mentioned something about deep shame.
Yes. There is a difference in the amount of shame one can feel. For instance, a lesser form of abuse would be something that you would think might have not happened. Like, did he really touch my breast, or was he really trying to unbutton my blouse? And so that's not near as traumatic as a lifetime of incestuous relationship with a father.
Mm-hmm.
They're so much different because of the length, because of the difference in power. So it takes a lot longer normally for someone who's been traumatized in a deep, deep way to overcome that sense of shame. I think that a child abuse survivor might label one particular incident as being more traumatic than the others or more shameful than the others, but both are really traumatizing. I think that the deep shame can come from a really humiliating instance of abuse, or where there's ritualistic abuse. That is is harder to recover from. I'm not saying that it can't be instantly healed, because God can do anything. Mm-hmm. But I'm saying traditionally, it just takes longer to work through that situation. And so, what about you on that trauma? Because you work with victims of trauma.
Yeah, and shame is so pervasive wherever. And it's a lie straight from the pit of hell who we are, really. I think what you said, who we are in Christ, you said it earlier, and you're much better at scripture memory than I am. So
sometimes I can't remember the addresses, yeah. But, it's that good old upbringing.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
I remembered my question.
Okay, good.
Okay. I was just wondering, and I know you can answer this in a million different ways, but what would you say would be the main reason why people don't want to see what's going on?
Like, they don't want to talk about their story, or they don't want to acknowledge it?
Like, they have trouble talking about it, trouble hearing anything that might remind them of something. And I'm not talking about something super traumatic, but you know how there are people in the world that are just avoiders. And they avoid everything. And I think that as they keep running, they just keep running into other issues and problems. But they come to a point where eventually they're either going to face it. So people just aren't ready to hear, how to fix something.
Right.
At certain times, they have to be ready.
Right. Well, from an abusive standpoint, I'll let Wayne answer from the traumatic standpoint. But if the abuse happened as a child, we have incredible mechanisms that we can put in place to help us survive, so that we may have snippets of a memory, but not have the whole memory. And you touched on the other thing that keeps that from happening, is the fact that our society is great at having distractions to where we don't have time alone to really focus on scripture and really be quiet to hear God's still small voice. Because of those distractions, that helps keep that away until someone keeps bumping up against the same problem when they finally figured out, oh, maybe there's something wrong with me instead of that relationship. Does that make sense?
Okay, so in relationships, you would say they would keep running into the same problem, and then one day realize, hey, there's something I haven't been noticing about my own behavior in this situation.
That happens a lot. It really does, because you're realizing, oh, I'm not forgiving everyone. So unforgiveness can begin that. Or a lot of times a client will come in and just say, I am having a lot of trouble with self-esteem. And then, of course, we turn them on to God esteem, because really in Christ we are his beloved creatures. So we begin to work on that and have some solitude and silence time so that they can listen to God.
But the people that come in there, they're ready, I think, more than someone who wouldn't walk through the doors.
Yes, I think they're ready. It's kind of, I almost hate to say this after all these years of school, but it's kind of like a frog could lead them there when they're ready. And maybe I'm understating things a lot, yeah. But I mean, when someone's ready, you will not keep them from discovering what they need to discover.
Yeah.
And it could be at any age.
Yes.
I want to think too, Ronnie, back to your original question about, why people don't go there. I think especially with shame, there's shame in feeling ashamed. I think to use such a clinical term of meta-emotional, the feeling about a feeling is so prevalent with shame in and of itself that we'll even push that further away sometimes.
So. That's good. That big word made up for my frog analogy. Yeah, hope so.
I didn't think of it.
Was it good?
I didn't think of it like that. That's cool.
Well, so How do you, I guess, are there, like we talked about earlier, I want to kind of go back to, if it's okay, about how you help people deal with shame. You said, you know, it was kind of like, I'm paraphrasing here, about establishing rapport and providing a really safe environment where they're not rushed to do this, but they're just, you know, feeling loved and accepted by you or the group.
Right.
And then I guess the other thing I think of, because of that, I work with addicts a lot, is this is why I love the 12 steps. Mm-hmm. Is it's that first step,
mm-hmm.
is really drive home and help them work through that we are powerless over our sin, over our addiction, over any of our behaviors or our feelings. We were powerless. So I think that's another step in that process too. Would you agree?
I agree. You know, I worked for a year and a half in chemical addiction recovery, and I have to tell you that was hard, because most addictive behavior began because of a trauma that wasn't dealt with. And I saw a huge difference in the clients who could see their higher power, and that they would claim and own God as a part of their process, to the ones who could never say that they had a higher power. And that was just, it was lost on them. Those clients, I was there long enough to see them come back 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 times. But the clients that had God in their lives had at least an 80% success rate, which in the addiction field is huge. So, you know, I just believe that, of course, our tagline is there's nothing the nearness of God cannot heal. And I really firmly believe that.
Sure, sure. So I think it's recognizing this powerlessness, and there is a higher power. And then for people that are struggling with sexual addiction, one of the things I have them do is take this, do the full inventory. You know, how does that, do you, with the person that's been abused, do you have them do any kind of inventory, maybe of what's been done?
Of what's been done.
So they know ultimately then at the end what they're forgiving or at some point, but.
Yes.
Does that work that way?
It does work that way, but it's a while in the process. It's not like the first
early on.
Thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it differs from the, in the 12 steps and that. But, and you know, it's really hard for a shame-based person to believe that they're beloved of God.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we're working toward. You know, the memorization of some key scriptures like John 3:16. You know, the very basic, God so loved the world that he gave. Mm. And he came and he gave his son for you, just that one person. That is a hard concept, because most abused women will say, no, he didn't. Or no, he won't.
Well, he did for you, but not for me.
Exactly.
That's, I hear that.
Because there's more, there's other people on the planet. So you really can't think of that in isolation. Mm. So, yeah, that's a little bit different. So how, and you see,
well,
that
is, well, for it's I have them do that inventory early, but then it, in the 12 steps, I think it's step 4 and step 9 that they do an inventory.
Mm-hmm.
But then the other thing that I see so important, not only for addictive behaviors but also for trauma survivors, is feeling the feelings. Cuz so many times I see, especially with men, is we want to go around the feeling.
Mm.
And then we just intellectualize it, and it doesn't get dealt with. I think feeling those feelings of shame, feel that. What does that mean? In the safety of a therapist's office or a group, but feel that. And I'm assuming there's something there.
Resistance.
Yeah. Yeah, lots of that.
Lots of resistance. Well, yes.
It's pride. In some cases?
Yes, it is pride in some cases. You know, I don't need God. I don't need somebody else. You know, there's probably as many excuses as there are people. Don't you think?
Mm-hmm.
Don't you see it presenting itself
differently?
But at some point, you know, I think it's important for the abused person to be able to tell the rest of that story and for the therapist to still be there because other people have backed up.
Mm-hmm. When you say backed up, you mean walked away or
became distant or won't pick up your phone calls or would never accept your invitation to lunch. I mean, they just back up because they don't know what to do. Mm. It scares them to death.
And they might think, well, every time I'm with this person, she or he is going to talk about this tragedy and I just can't handle it. Mm-hmm. And they need someone to listen.
They do.
To hear them.
They do.
And say, I know how you feel. And then once they get through it all, then the person who's backing up doesn't realize that it's going to get better. And I can have a great relationship with this person if I give in to what they need from me.
No, you're right. And in fact, it usually gets worse before it gets better. And that's really hard. I try to state that. Do you, mm-hmm. Wayne?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And it's kind of hard to see their face fall. What do you mean it's going to get? Well, I thought I was at the worst when I came in here. But, you know, digging that stuff up is very painful.
Yeah. And well, yeah, when you ask somebody to feel those feelings of inadequacy or worthlessness or, you know, mistrust, loneliness, sadness, anger, and rage, you ask them to feel that with you in the office. And I don't say it just like that, but, you know,
right.
That's where we go.
But that's where you go.
It's hard for them at times.
You know, I'm going to ask a little bit different question.
Okay.
Because you work with trauma. Well, we both work with trauma, but you know EMDR.
Mm-hmm.
You might talk a little bit of that. And then I'd like to talk about... maybe when we come back, I guess. I'm watching the clock. But the difference between grief and trauma.
Okay.
And where does grief fit in all this?
Okay. That's probably a good topic after we get back, right?
Yes.
Okay. So we're going to take a break. Thanks for being with us. And we'll be back in just a minute.
If you could have the marriage you've always wanted, even after being cheated on. If you could avoid losing a huge chunk of your standard of living, why would you sentence yourself to an empty, lonely room? Divorce sucks. The emotional trauma and financial loss are much worse than what you think. And infidelity can be cured. It's not as hopeless as it seems. AffairRecovery.com. Almost 90% of the couples completing our program not only enjoy restored marriages, they report a much higher level of marital satisfaction. AffairRecovery.com. Don't give up before it gets better. Join the ranks of those who found new life. AffairRecovery.com. Where healing happens.
Does your life seem void of meaning? Do you struggle with depression? Is marriage not turning out as expected? Are you disappointed in the intimacy you share? Has an unwanted behavior taken your life hostage? Do uncontrollable feelings flood uninvited into your life? If so, we can help. Crossroads Counseling is a group of highly trained mental health professionals dedicated to Jesus. Crossroads Counseling is unique in its team approach. Each member has developed a specialty in order to complement their overall goal of helping each person they serve experience the freedom and abundant life afforded through the life of Christ. Give us a call, 512-346-9299. That's 512-346-9299. Or visit our website at crossroads-counseling.net. There is hope and healing. We believe there's nothing the nearness of God cannot heal.
So welcome back to A Fair Recovery Radio. I'm here with Dr. Karen Royer. My name is Wayne Baker. I want to tell you real quickly that we have an emergency marriage seminar coming up February 21st through the 23rd.
That's what we're thinking. It's that weekend that begins with it. Yeah, it's the third weekend.
And if you don't know, the EMS weekend emergency marriage seminar is designed to help couples recovering from or through any type of infidelity, whether it's sexual addiction, affairs, emotional affairs, one-night stands, or long-term affairs. And we would love to host you if you are find yourself qualified for that weekend. Please give us a call at 512-346-9299. Or go to our website, which is affairrecovery.com, and all the information will be there.
You know, Wayne, that weekend is amazing.
It is, and it's like holy ground to me.
It really is. I've gotten to watch, of course, my husband and I went through that, but I've also watched three other weekends, and it's amazing what happens between Friday morning and Sunday afternoon.
Yeah,
it is life-changing stuff.
Yeah, don't you think? I mean, we here in the natural, with our eyes, there are days, Friday mornings when we start, we like, how in the world is this going to happen? And we take a small group, really. You know, maximum so far has been 10 couples that we have taken through at a time. And you start Friday morning thinking, there's no way.
Mm-hmm.
And then usually I think things start to turn around by Sunday morning.
I agree.
Know, Saturday evening, and it's holy ground. I don't know any other way to describe it.
You're right. I hadn't thought of that, but it is holy ground. Yeah. And the changes that happen, we've seen sustain over time. Mm. So it works.
Yeah, it really does. So please give us a call or go to the website at affairrecovery.com if you find yourself in need of that.
So, Wayne, you were going to talk to us a little bit about what EMDR is and how you use that with trauma.
Well, EMDR stands for eye movement, desensitization, and reprocessing. And it is a way of dealing with traumatic memories, both big T and little T. And we know that trauma of all sorts gets stuck in the right hemisphere, which is the the irrational, creative, emotional side of us. And we've got to pull it over to the left hemisphere where we can make sense of it with our analytical, logical side of us. And what I find is that, having done this, or had it done to me quite a bit, it's not like you forget, but some of these traumatic memories, whether it was something done to you or that you did to someone else, it doesn't hold the power over you anymore. And research shows that it works really well for 40 to 50% of the population really quickly. And then for about another 40%, it takes a little bit longer. Mm. And then for about 10%, it doesn't work at all. And there's no test to
tell.
You just got
to
try it. And some people process very slowly. And you start with a negative memory or a picture.
Mm-hmm.
And then the negative cognition or the negative belief that you have about yourself as a result of that event or memory. And then you just start processing that network of memory that the brain has associated with the target. And I incorporate healing prayer. I'm not certified in Theophostic.
Mm-hmm.
That's on my list. But I just do some healing prayer with folks as we get going. And again, there are days where it's amazing. I'm most recently, maybe not most recent, but here in recent history, I've worked with a woman that had lost her mom when she was 12 years old, and now she's in her early 40s.
Mm.
And this was the first Christmas that she was able to participate and not get a blanket and crawl up in a hole and cry for days.
Amazing.
So the grief may be this overwhelming sense of sadness, you know, that in her case has lasted 30 years.
Hmm.
Contrast that to some trauma where it's more about the terror of an event or I just lost my train of thought. But I think that that's a key difference is the sadness with the grief work. And I think you said it earlier too, that unresolved grief is the key or the backbone to a lot of addictive behavior, a lot of depression, a lot of stuff that we see in our offices. It's unresolved grief.
It's true. You know, I don't want to cut you off if you're not
fine,
finished, but I've started incorporating some grief models with abuse recovery because it's never talked about. Because there is loss there. There's a loss of innocence. For some, there's a loss of childhood. For some, there's loss of the dream of being a virgin on your wedding day. I mean, there's all kinds of loss surrounding that. So I do see that as unresolved grief, and it's important to be able to guide people through that process.
Yeah. Well, I think, too, the unresolved grief, that it just leads to everything. And I see that with a lot of people that come in with rage or anger issues, too. Especially for men, it's just easier for us to be angry than it is for us to grieve and feel the feelings that we need to be feeling to be able to work through it.
So is anger and rage, can it be a result of abuse?
I would say so.
I think so. But it seems like, and again, men coming forward with abusive characteristics is not happening too often.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, it's becoming more and more accepted. It's such a taboo subject for men. But I've seen several men over the past few months, and I see rage and anger as a real outward sign of that abuse that just hasn't been dealt with.
Yeah.
And the anger is just escalating.
Well, and you know, and we talk about all the time too, how the anger and the rage is not the primary thing. It's something else. When we concentrate on the guilt and the inferiority, the fear and the trauma, but the shame is probably wrapped in there somewhere.
Sure. So. That makes sense.
So you had some other things that you wanted to touch on for the abused person that's dealing with shame.
Well, I do have a couple of other thoughts. I wanted to give a couple of book titles.
Oh yeah,
out,
that's great.
And you may have some more. But if you're really struggling with that core belief that I'm not worthy or I'm not good enough, I think the best book to search out on that is The Search for Significance by McGee, don't you?
Mm-hmm. It's a good book.
And it now has a workbook connected with the book so that you can work through it. He also has a new book called Search for Peace, which
I didn't know that.
I got to look through the other day. And, of course, it's on my extra long list of books to order. And, of course, The Wounded Heart and The Wounded Heart Workbook from a Christian perspective. Mm. Those are great. And there is also a book by Diane Langberg on The Threshold of Hope, which is also excellent in this arena. And if you're interested in children who have been abused, there is a new book called Interviewing Children About Sexual Abuse, Controversies and Best Practice by Kathleen Fowler. And that is an excellent book also.
Well, you know, the one I would add is Neil Anderson. I'm a huge fan of his work. And in a book he has out is called Breaking the Bonds of Legalism. And he addresses pretty head on fear, shame, guilt, and pride all in that book. It's a great little book.
Okay.
So, not a little book, but it's pretty big. But
yeah, he's just excellent on everything.
Yeah.
I had a couple of acronyms that I thought might be helpful as we kind of round things up. But if you write out the word abused, and this is before you get help, the A stands for anger. I'm always angry and mad. And B stands for belonging. I'm feeling isolated and no one cares. D The U stands for understood, because you're never understood or you feel that way. The S is, of course, for shame. I feel blame, shame, and guilt for everything. Entrapped is the E. There's no way out. And D is disgrace. There is no love and no honor. I'm humiliated. But once you get help, we're hoping that you can move to an A with, I now have righteous anger. I've become an advocate. I can speak up for others as well as myself. And the B is belonging. I belong to the family of God and I am loved. That central message is so important to go from head to heart. The U stands for understood. I'm totally accepted and cared for. And the S in shame now is, my guilt and shame are gone because I'm forgiven in Jesus Christ. He took my shame upon himself. Ensnared, I'm protected by God and his way. And D is now death. Jesus died so we can be reborn in him. There's no more disgrace, but God's grace instead. And I love that shift in that word.
And that's a shift that we all have to make, don't you think?
It is.
I mean, every one of us really does. It sounds too like a lot of internalization for the abused person. I mean, it's they just take everything on themselves. Mm-hmm. Is that it's all their fault. He touched me, or he molested me, or raped me, or whatever. And even that, it's still my fault.
Say it is their fault. It's one of those cognitive distortions that we talk about a lot of time. There are 10 cognitive distortions, and one of them is, feeling that you're responsible for everything that happens to you. So, yeah, it's real important. And, the book keeps coming to mind, and I guess I should mention it, is Richard Rohr's book. It's R-O-H-R, Everything Belongs, which is just fabulous. And another one, he has a tape called Breathing Underwater.
Yeah, I've listened to that. I haven't read the book yet.
Is that right?
Yeah. Breathing Underwater.
Excellent resources, because you begin to develop some contemplative into your life, and that might be the next program.
Yeah. Well, and I think, and thinking along those lines with Richard Rohr and what he says in this, the kind of contemplative lifestyle or prayer life, or, find out in the midst of that, understanding the function that shame has served in our lives to this point. I think that's a crucial early step as well. It served some function. It may not be good,
right?
But it's serving a function.
And
so find out what that is. And also, you mentioned earlier too, the defense mechanisms that go along with it that try to get us to reduce that shame. Being able to recognize, am I blaming or am I being a victim, or rationalizing what I've done or what was done to me. I think those are kind of crucial first steps that help us make that shift that you're talking about.
I think you're right. And understanding that you have suppressed stuff, and that's okay. And now,
because we all do.
Yeah, we all do. And it's okay. And just pray for God to return whatever memories he wants for you to have,
Yeah.
Don't go on a hunt for them, because he will bring them to mind if he wants you to have those.
Yeah. Yeah, because you can rack yourself silly by hunting for something.
If
he wants you to know, he will reveal it. There's plenty of things he's revealed to us that we can be dealing with instead of going looking for something else.
I totally agree. Is that right? There's plenty of stuff there to deal with.
True in my
true
own
for
life.
Me.
Yeah. And then also changing those negative core beliefs. And I believe that is the work, like you're talking about in the shift, the work of the Holy Spirit, and us surrendering to him and to the conviction that he brings.
I agree. It was a process for me too, because I honestly, as much scripture as I know and as much as I'd read, it wasn't till about 3 years ago that I could truly say I'm God's beloved child. And really believe it. So it took me a long time. And so I think being patient with yourself is another thing But realizing that that's what you're striving for is to feel like God's precious child.
Yeah. And like you said, I think that's a journey for all of us. And it's it comes bit by bit. And hopefully 10 years from now, we'll know that more fully than we do today.
Yes.
Don't you think?
Because it's a process. It's a journey.
Yeah. Well, this has been fun. This has been a learning experience for me to talk to you about how the abused person experiences shame versus how the addicted person might experience it. But some of the same emotions just kind of manifest maybe a little bit differently.
It's been really good. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you. Well, so what are we going to talk about next time?
I don't know. Contemplative yeah, lifestyle right. sounds really right. good.
and I'm not sure who's here next week. I think it's Rick.
I think it's Rick, and he's interviewing.
You're interviewing someone. But we sure appreciate you guys being with us tonight. Thanks for joining us. And remember to check out theaffairrecovery.com. For more information on our EMS weekend, all our radio programs are archived there, and there's just tons of information on the website. We really appreciate you guys being with us tonight, and we'll see you soon. Thanks.
Thanks. Good night.
Thank you for joining us tonight and being a part of the newest addition to our services, Affair Recovery Radio, radio through the power of God. We'd like to invite you to go to our website, affairrecovery.com, and register for our free newsletter, as well as taking advantage of our free podcast. You will find that these resources are invaluable if you're trying to recover from some form of betrayal. We are here to help. We can also be contacted at 888-5-ARC-EMS. That's 888-5-ARC-EMS. And remember, there's nothing the nearness of God cannot heal.
Good night. God bless.
Then the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah, I am the Lord, the God of all mankind. Is anything too hard for me?
Loving God and loving others. The Word, KLGO, Thorndale, Austin, K288 FJ, Bastrop, and K253 AN, Sunset Valley, Austin.
Hi, my name is Ruby House. You're listening.